Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hey, everybody. We've got an interesting one today. You know, for a change. I have 2 guests to talk about this midterm ahead of us. John Anzalone, who's a pollster, who works for, among other politicians, Joseph R. Biden, the President of the United States, and for his second time on the Al Franken podcast, my friend D. Taylor. D. is the head of Unite Here, the hospitality workers union, who, in my opinion, do the best ground game in the country. They hit the doors, they knock on doors, and talk to folks on their front steps. Now, let me tell you a little something I've observed in politics over the last 15-20 years, and that is that polling, traditional polling in political races, is just getting less and less reliable. We've seen in the last several cycles polling that's just off. It's just harder and harder to poll Americans now. Americans don't particularly like talking to pollsters. It used to be, of course, that pollsters could poll people by calling their home phones and get them. Now, not so much. It's just harder. And the results have been much less reliable. Now, I have this Political Action Committee, Midwest Values PAC, MVP, and like all PACs, we raise and then give away money to candidates or to state parties that I support. And over the years, MVP has been investing more and more of our resources in ground game. Last cycle, we were the first to give to Unite Here, both in Nevada and in Georgia. Unite Here ended up knocking on 3 million doors in Georgia just for the runoff. And of course, we got Ossoff and Warnock because of that, thank God. Detailer is just great. You will hear Dee talk about what they are now hearing on the doors. And Dee will tell you that what people are talking about is the cost of rent, cost of food, the cost of gas, buying new clothes for their kids for school. Now, there's a reason the Inflation Reduction Act is called the Inflation Reduction Act. And by the way, it's not an effective argument on the door to say, well, you know, this is an international thing, this inflation. In fact, inflation in Hungary is almost 2 points higher than our inflation. And that's a right-wing government. That argument doesn't work. People don't really care about that. Now, there are a number of provisions in the Inflation Reduction Act that should help reduce inflation. Increased taxes on mega wealthy individuals, large corporations will pay a minimum tax of 15%. We've had these hugely profitable corporations pay no income tax at all. Well, now they're going to pay, and that will bring down the deficit and put some check on inflation. But also, now Medicare will be able to negotiate with the pharmaceutical companies, just like every other government in the developed world negotiates with their pharma. We pay 2 to 3 times as much as European countries pay for the same drugs, half of which we produce. So that will be a big help, families being able to pay for the medicine that they need. And this legislation stops increases in health insurance premiums in the ACA that Americans otherwise would have experienced. And of course, there's the little matter of a $370 billion investment, the largest investment in history in addressing climate change, and it will bring down carbon emissions by an estimated 40% by 2030. I don't want my grandchildren 50 years from now saying, Grandpa, you were in the Senate. Why didn't you all do something about climate change? And also, Grandpa, why are you still alive? This is a big fucking deal. And I will tell you that I talked to both Anzalone and Taylor before that bill passed and was signed, so you should know that. I've been on the road doing my act. I guest hosted Jimmy Kimmel Live last Tuesday. That was a gas, 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 as Mick Jagger used to say. I had a great time on Kimmel. You can watch chunks of that on YouTube. My guests were Bob Odenkirk, my friend of 35 years. He started writing on SNL when I was there in 1987. Bob, of course, the star of Better Call Saul. We had him and his co-star, Ray Seahorn, on the night after the finale of Better Call Saul. The show I hosted was on Tuesday. The finale of Saul was on Monday evening. And I had pre-taped a bit with Bob on Monday. And Bob asked me to come over to watch the party at his house that evening to watch the finale with a number of the Better Call Saul cast, the creators, Vince Gilligan and Peter Gould, the writers, actors, artists, who some of them have been working on Saul and Breaking Bad for 12, 13 years. And I've, as I said, I know Bob since 1987, so he knows me, he knows my family. So on Monday, he invites me, my son, who's in from New York, to go to Kimmel, and my daughter and her husband to come to this watch party at his house to watch the finale of this 13-year project. Now, you have to understand, the Frankens, we're all huge Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul fan. We're fanatics. Wow. So this thing is airing at 9, I guess. We go over to Bob's house, and everybody there has thrown their hearts and their souls, years of their lives, into this amazing artistic achievement. There's a few spouses there who've lived with this for years, their husbands and wives spending 8 months a year in Albuquerque working. My family, we've done nothing. Nothing. It's Bob's living room. There are maybe 20, 25 other people there. Before the finale starts, Bob opens up. And with this amazing emotional speech, he's crying, they're crying. The Frankens, my daughter, her husband, my son, and I, we're looking at each other. It's like, we don't belong here. On the other hand, this is amazing. We have all been obsessed with their work, Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, for, again, 12, 13 years. And this is it for them. This is the last time these people will be together like this. So they're crying and laughing and hugging and loving each other. There's Nacho hugging Howard. There's Kim hugging Vince Gilligan. Now, we're not going to leave because, you know, we're super fans. But this is Bob's living room. So we're looking at each other. Okay, let's sit in the worst seats in the back. Bob grabs Thompson, my daughter. Thompson, sit with me. So she's on the couch in front of the TV between Odenkirk and his wife, Naomi. So my son and my son-in-law, Brody, and I retreat, trying to be as invisible as possible. Finally, the show starts, and we're watching. It's great. It was so moving, the finale. And the folks there are crying. They're cheering. It ends cheering, standing O's, hugs, more speeches, crying, laughing. We're crying. Now, the Frank is just, we just frankly want to get out of there. Just slip away and let them have this. Let them have this time, this moment. And Bob says, the Frankens, they represent the audience, the most important element of all. We wouldn't exist without the audience. Al, say something. Now, everyone has spoken. Everyone's face is flushed with joy and cheer and love, and they look to me. And I just say, I've known Bob for 35 years, and I can't believe he got this thing. And then we just hightail it out of there. I'm hosting Kimmel the next day. I got to think, prepare about that. And look, we know we're going to savor this evening forever. Frankens, we're walking down the hill toward our car, and we're going like, what the hell was that? Why were we allowed there? And my son, Joe, who, like me, is a long, long-suffering, die-hard Vikings fan, says, it's like the Vikings finally won the Super Bowl, and for some reason, we get invited to the locker room for the celebration, and I yell, "We did it!" And that was exactly what it was like. It was just crazy. So, okay, back to the midterms. Now, I will admit that I talked to John Anzalone a while ago. I've been traveling a bit. I talked to him before this big legislative achievement, before Roe came down. And we've seen the results in Kansas, where Kansans voted with a 60% majority to keep women's reproductive rights in that state intact. Kansas is a red state, 60%. I want to make sure that a woman who wants an abortion can get an abortion. That's big. That says something. This huge legislative achievement signed this past week by this president, that is a big fucking deal. And this election, my friends, my listeners, this is a big fucking deal. Look, I have never been a fan of Republicans, but they have become a party that has ceased good faith participation in the democratic process. Not long ago, the Republican National Committee called the January 6th insurrection legitimate political discourse. This started a while ago. In 1995, I wrote Rush Limbaugh is a big fat idiot and other observations. After Republicans took the House for the first time in 40 years, Newt Gingrich named Rush an honorary member of the class of 95. Coinciding with the rise of Gingrich was the ascent of conservative talk radio, followed by Fox News, followed by the advent of social media. Combined, they've created a media environment that allows Republican politicians and their voters to seal themselves in an echo chamber of alternative facts. The Republican Party has become an authoritarian faction fighting democracy. They've destroyed truth, decency. They've destroyed national unity. They've destroyed their own party. And they're trying to destroy the world's oldest democracy. They are running candidates for Secretary of State in Nevada, in Arizona, in Minnesota, all over the country who don't believe Joe Biden won the election, who believe that unless Republicans win the election was stolen. Let me tell you, folks, this is a crisis time. Our democracy is literally at stake. Now, this is not the most important election in American history. That was 1860. But these midterms literally may determine the future of our democracy. So, before we turn to Detailer and John Anzalone, I want to tell you, my listeners, it's not enough to vote. You got to make phone calls. You got to knock on doors. Now, I know many of you have jobs. Many of you have families. Ignore them. Let me tell you something. An 8-year-old can operate a microwave oven. And let me tell you this. An 8-year-old can teach a 4-year-old to use a microwave oven. So get out there. Do the work. Otherwise, we're going to lose this democracy. I am not kidding. There are state legislative races. There are state secretary of state races. There are attorneys general races, governors, seats in Congress, U.S. Senate seats. Every one of these counts. Get off your butts. We've got John Anzalone and Detailer. An informative one today. You know, for a change.
When the news cycle gets busy, it can be tough to keep up with healthy habits. Thrive Market makes it easy to get high-quality groceries delivered right to your door so you can focus on what matters. They carry trusted brands like Rouse and Chomps, and every product is free from over 1,000 sketchy ingredients. With Thrive Market, you can restock your pantry with clean snacks and staples, all without leaving the couch. Go to thrivemarket.com/podcast and get 30% off your first order and a free $60 gift.
So everyone should know you're a pollster, you're Biden's pollster, but you're also a pollster for a lot of other Democrats. Let me ask you about just a few pollster questions or stuff that I'm sure you think about. The Hispanic vote, the Latino vote, of course, that's very large in Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
And we have been, I remember when the Republicans lost in 12, Romney lost, there was the autopsy and they said, well, we're losing all these people. So, we need to change our policies. And of course they went the opposite way. They went to Trump, but there seems to be a segment of Latino voters who are coming toward the Republican Party. And can you tell us who they are? Are they more the men? And is that about religion? Is that conservatives? Social conservatives? What is that?
I think that, first of all, we should acknowledge that it's really actually fairly complicated. Like, the Latino vote is not homogeneous.
I don't like that. You see, on this podcast, we try to really make things simple for everyone.
Yeah.
But go ahead. Go ahead.
But the thing is, this is how I think it is, that our research and the research of, you know, Matt Barreto at Latino Decisions, who's just a fantastic pollster and was part of our Biden team and does work for Building Back Together. The reality is that he would probably tell you as well, Latinos don't think as a group that, oh, they're Latinos. They're much more associate with their nationality. Are we Mexican American? Are we Venezuelan? Are we Cuban? Are we Colombian? Are we, you know, et cetera. And so that's important to know. And, you know, the fact is that John Salazar, who was a client of mine in the Western Front of Colorado, you know, his family had been in Colorado for like hundreds and hundreds of years.
Texas was Mexico.
Yeah, there's Latinos in Western Colorado who are so different than Latinos in Dade County, right? That's my point. You know, we can't think of them as a monolithic group, and you have to really, I believe, treat Latinos and quite frankly, all voters as persuadable voters. And I think that you asked about demographics within. We are having our biggest problem with male Latinos, without a doubt, and some younger Latinos. We're still very strong with female Latinos. And it just depends on kind of like the region. I mean, Cuban Americans have always been a more conservative universe. I think one of the things that people don't realize is that there is a larger and larger universe of Hispanic Americans who are becoming evangelical in their faith. So, you know, moving from the Catholic Church to evangelical or Pentecostal, I mean, I live in the South and, you know, if you're in the South, you kind of get the, you know, church on Wednesday, twice on Sunday, very evangelical. The Bible is a literal hand of God, all of that. And it's much just different. And that is the biggest increase in Pentecostal and evangelical in America are Latinos. The other thing I think that we tend to just think of is we tend to think of the Latino community in Texas and, oh, it's important in Florida. But when you take a look at states like battleground states, Georgia. Like Georgia and North Carolina, the fastest growing population, you know, it's the right. fastest population is Latino. And so, you know, Senator Warnock, really, it'll be a really big deal. There's an open seat in North Carolina. Listen, I think that part of it is also economic because of inflation. You know, Latinos, African Americans, younger people, which are big parts of our base. Even though we've had lost some of the Latino vote, we still win them by large margins.
And more and more are becoming voting age, right?
Right. And but those universes are impacted at a much higher intensity with inflation. And so, you know, there's economic anxiety there at a higher level. Again, once the campaign, you know, TV and digital and radio and mail season starts, we have very strong messaging in terms of what we do for middle class voters and voters who are Latino and African American and young voters, et cetera. And we, you know, have just started doing the communication on that.
To what extent are you, I mean, you've been doing this for 30 years. The information universe has changed wildly in that time.
Mm-hmm.
And disinformation, what role does disinformation play now in politics? I think it's obvious it plays a large role, that people are much more divided because they get their information from completely different sources.
Yeah, it's the political pandemic. I mean, it you know, President Obama just gave a speech at Stanford, I believe. I don't know if you listened to it. I mean, everyone should. I mean, it really is the scourge of politics. And the fact is in 2020, when I was doing the Biden campaign and we would get these disinformation reports, it'd make your skin crawl. The Republicans are willing to do and say just about anything, right?
Yeah, and they don't seem to care.
They don't care. And, you know, I mean, even it's just crazy. I was watching a Dean Heller ad in in Nevada today, and he's talking about how Democrats are teaching critical race to your children. Well, critical race isn't taught in any elementary, middle, or high school in America, but they will say that. I would say that where the disinformation is at the height of changing voter opinion, one in is rural areas, because we don't have a pushback. There's like, it's a void of information. In rural America, the GOP has a singular monopoly in their voice, and we don't push back. And then the Latino community, because it is one, is very hard to detect, you know, very a lot on WhatsApp and things like that. And I think that part of our erosion in 2020 just had to do with Latinos, had to do with the disinformation campaigns. I mean, like, they will do anything. I will point you to one way I think that we have to fight this, is that we have to compete in these areas where we don't communicate. Rural America is a perfect example. America Bridge, which was one of the largest independent expenditures in 2020 for the president, picked 70 counties in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, kind of, you know, Trump counties. And they said, our goal is just to narrow the margins by 3, 5, 7 points in these counties. And they put a full court press on communicating Democratic messaging, what Biden was going to do, use local people to express that message. And they did just that.
How are these local people expressing this on local news? Where are they doing this?
A lot of what they were doing was talking about how they were Trump voters and, you know, how he had disappointed them and they weren't going to vote for him again. And they were kind of explaining.
Okay, were these ads or what were they?
Oh, yeah, these were TV ads. These were mail. This was like they did a real paid communication program. But when you think about how close those three states were and, you know, the fact that they closed the margin in those counties by, well, I think it was an average 5 points, but there were some counties that were as much as 10 points. That is significant. And, you know, I've done a lot of work in the South. Roy Cooper, for example, in North Carolina. Doing rural radio is a major part of our strategy, right? Is talking to rural voters.
Let me ask you about talk radio. Because you said they have sort of a hold on rural areas because the information they get is from largely from talk radio, I assume.
But it's Facebook. I mean, it's social media. I mean, they're dominating everything that they see. They're, you know, we're not competing.
Well, rural voters get Facebook and urban voters. Yeah, I mean, right. Why are we not competing with rural voters?
I don't want this to sound as a huge criticism because guess what? This takes money. Like, right? I mean, we're in a modern presidency now. I don't care whether you're a Democrat or Republican. To cut through the media noise, you might as well just need $1 billion every year in paid communication to compete, right? To get your message out. It's difficult. But the fact is that in these big races, you know, we need a strategy in these really tough parts of each of these states to not get beat 70-30 and maybe just get beat 65-35.
So what does that look like? Explain to me what that looks like. Why on Facebook and other social media we're not competing in that way? And you're saying that's money. It's money. You take out ads. What is that?
I think part of it's money. I mean, the fact is that TV, radio, digital, social media, mail, I mean, it's all very expensive. I think that to some extent, you know, we've almost gone overboard.
So it's ads on Facebook? That's what I'm trying to find out.
Yeah,
what exactly.
Yeah. I mean, sure. I mean, you know, when you're buying digital, you're buying, you know, a bunch of different platforms.
Well, you know, it was a great decision by the Supreme Court, Citizens United.
Yeah, that was an awesome one. That, you know, that was really great for billionaires who wanted to be involved in politics.
I just think that, you know, I fear for our democracy. And if you look at, you know, I don't want to go through the litany of how undemocratic, America, our system of government has become, 45%. Of population represented by Republicans in the Senate, court 6-3, gerrymandering in the states that the Supreme Court would address, and then Citizens United, just this flood of dark money. It's scary, huh?
Yeah, listen, I mean, when I started in this business, you know, 99% of paid communications for a campaign, congressional campaign, Senate campaign, governor's campaign, was raised and spent by that candidate. And now most of the money, if you're running for Senate in North Carolina and you're the Democrat or you're the Republican, there's most likely more money will be spent on the independent expenditure side, which you have no control of and you legally cannot have any coordination, versus the actual candidate. That is our system right now. You can make a decision whether you think that's good or bad, but the fact is that there's a lot of unlimited money out there that is not disclosed and spoiling the system. And then nowadays, there's like also really big money out there that people are super happy to tell you about. And they're going in there and they're influencing, you know, individual congressional races by doing an independent expenditure where one or two people are, you know, doing $1 million or $2 million. And they're just, they're happy to say that they're doing that.
And here's the thing, I believe, well, we have our billionaires too.
Well, not as good as their billionaires though, are they? They don't seem to be as efficient.
Well, you know, here's what I'm thinking about that, which is their billionaires are right-wing billionaires. And the Koch brothers, they have this oil empire, right? This oil, and so what they're actually paying for something. And so I have the feeling like for every $1 billion they spend, they kind of feel like we're getting back $1.5 billion or $2 billion. In other words, I think that this is actually in their financial interest.
Yeah.
And okay, maybe we have some real estate person in New York who gives to Chuck Schumer and, you know, something shows up in a bill that helps real estate developers in New York or something. But mainly, it just seems like, you know, the George Soroses of the world, who, by the way, is a puppet master for the Jewish puppet master for Democrats. I mean, he's for democracy. He's for, you know, he's not doing anything to fill his pockets.
This is probably maybe controversial. I feel like maybe their billionaire is a little more pragmatic in what they're trying to do. But, you know, listen, there's a lot of money spent on both sides. And guess what? There's a lot of money pissed away on both sides, right? That's not particularly efficient in the end game of winning races. And maybe, again, we're too principled or we want to, you know.
Well, I think every campaign should spend money on a consultant who shows you how to spend money more efficiently.
Well, I also think that on the Democratic, I think on the Democratic side, we've kind of let, in some races, I've seen this in some races where you kind of let analytics, the big data, drive where you're spending money. And, you know, that's why you're never communicating in rural areas. You don't believe it's efficient.
One way to win in rural areas for a candidate is go to rural areas. Just get to know the people in your state, and you can disagree with them and say
so. Listen, I always tell the story about Mark Warner, who I think is a really smart guy, but also a politically astute guy, is that if you take a look at his first campaign where he won, I guess, for governor, I mean, he lived in Southwest Virginia, like, right? Appalachia, not his comfort level probably, but he went down to NASCAR, Virginia, and camped out because he knew that that was really important. Because, you know, he couldn't just be an Alexandria guy. He took the time to spend down there, which I think was really important.
That's what you have to do. And you get a perspective. And there is a perspective of Americans that are resentful of elites. And in many ways, they look at Democrats as elites.
I mean, I think that, you know, is pretty evident that we can, when I say we, I think the DC kind of insider Democratic elites talk down to people. I live in Montgomery, Alabama, and people can't fucking understand how I could ever associate with anyone down here. Well, they've never been down here and lived here and met people. Like, you've got to, you know, not look down on people, and you've got to try to understand where they're coming from.
Yeah, looking down on people and clearly looking down on people is not a great way to win votes.
And can I also add to this, since we're on this line, we look down on people's faith as Democrats at a very large level. And I'd hate to generalize, but I think it's really true. And I've been at the other end of this where people, you know, Democratic consultants having this conversation, can't kind of understand my faith and why I go to church and all this type of stuff. And we tend to really knock people of faith.
I don't knock Jews because I'm Jewish.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's done me well. you got to respect people. And yeah, I think freedom of religion was actually in the First Amendment, and people feel very strongly about that, and they have a right to their religious beliefs. And that's why I think that this abortion decision is so heinous.
Yeah,
because it really doesn't respect people's actual religious beliefs. It just the Catholics on the court have dictated this policy.
I mean, the biggest irony in American politics is that the evangelicals in America have become the base for MAGA and Trumpism. Basically, politics has taken over evangelical churches.
Well, what happened was that Trump pledged to have the Supreme Court nominees chosen by the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation.
Yeah.
And evangelicals sort of made a deal in their head is that they'll take the guy who brags about grabbing women by their crotch, and they'll take him because he'll appoint, and we've seen the result, appoint anti-choice judges.
It's just sickening.
Yeah, it really is.
And I mean, yeah, that evangelicals, you know, haven't called out this guy whose moral behavior is repugnant.
Can I ask you about labor and how we reconnect with labor? I feel like there's a lot of young guys in Minnesota who say work in the Iron Range who. It used to be solidly Democratic, and it was because these are really good paying jobs, you know, working in the iron ore mines. And they got them because of unions. Is there something where we're not, unions aren't doing something right? Or
so this is a little mystifying to me. I got to tell you, I am the son of two union members. My dad was a long haul trucker. He was a Teamster. He had a great line in Michigan, like he was local 7 in Kalamazoo. He was a Jimmy Hoffa Teamster. And my dad said, mm-hmm. I didn't know I was a Democrat till Jimmy Hoffa told me so. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, and my mom was a public employee. And it was of great benefit to us with healthcare and things like that. What's been mystifying to me over the last couple of years, especially during the pandemic, and you see, you know, people on the front lines and et cetera. I actually thought that we would see a little bump in union membership because we're in a time where, you know, workers have kind of a new voice, right? That hasn't materialized. And I don't know whether that is, you know, there's not enough effort on organizing or whatever. I'm not trying to be critical in any way for labor. I'm just telling you, I thought that we're in this environment that you would seem would be ripe for, you know, new union membership. And I hope that that happens. I mean, we've seen some successes here and there in Starbucks or one in Amazon and things like that. But, you know, in terms of, you know, reconnecting, we see it depends on what state you're in that we are underperforming with union households like we should. We had a bump back up in 2018 and 2020, but at times we're fighting hard because a lot of the labor unions are, you know, filled with middle class white males. And that is a tough group for Democrats right now, almost everywhere.
I also just wonder if they're almost generational differences between older union members who are going to retire soon and have their pensions and younger ones who are looking at pensions and wondering if they're going to get them.
Also, unions aren't, I mean, like union members in Michigan, which are a little bit more manufacturing based, are super different than union members in Nevada, which are more culinary, right? And casino.
By the way, they're great. The hospitality workers, the culinary workers.
Yeah, I mean they're fantastic. They move mountains.
I support them with my pack. They're like my favorite thing to give to.
If you're a UAW member in Macomb County, think of Reagan Democrats, you know, Macomb County, and you're a 55-year-old white male who think that you're the new victim in America, right? And there's a lot of cross pressures on you. You're a union member, but at the same time, you know, white males over 50 are voting in droves for Republicans for a bunch of different reasons, including the border or, you know, you can, you know, critical race theory or whatever. We're losing America, you know, the whiteness of America and things like that. So that's where we're seeing a ton of cross pressure. But it is generational because, for example, in Michigan, you know, one of the reasons that Democrats can do a little better in Michigan with older voters is that there is a retired universe of union members who culturally grew up Democrat. And so we do a little better with seniors, for example, in a place like Michigan than, you know, pick the other state.
Well, thank you, John. We don't know how this is going to turn out, do we?
We don't know how it's going to. I'm like, you know, I try to say it's like it could be kind of a bad night or it could be an ass kicking night. But listen, you know, $8 billion is going to be spent. Hopefully there's something that'll be passed on reconciliation that'll give us a little boost on messaging. You know, we got to go out there and fight, man. We got to fight and fight hard. You know, you said it. There's just so much at stake. I don't want to hear any about the defeatism because there's time. And I think that we actually have the tools in our toolkit to compete.
My thanks to John Anzalone. After we take a break, we'll be right back with Dee Taylor of Unite Here.
When the news cycle gets busy, it can be tough to keep up with healthy habits. Thrive Market makes it easy to get high-quality groceries delivered right to your door so you can focus on what matters. They carry trusted brands like Rouse and Chomps, and every product is free from over 1,000 sketchy ingredients. With Thrive Market, you can restock your pantry with clean snacks and staples, all without leaving the couch. Go to thrivemarket.com/podcast and get 30% off your first order and a free $60 gift.
Welcome back. We're talking about the midterms, very important midterms. We've been talking to John Anzalone, and now we're turning to Dee Taylor, head of Unite Here's ground game effort, and my pleasure to be talking to him. Dee, I have done no preparation for this podcast.
I made a cup of coffee.
Explain Unite Here to our listeners.
Unite Here is a union that represents people in hotels, food service like stadiums, cafeterias, casinos, arenas, often food service on universities too.
Sometimes known as hospitality workers, is that?
Sometimes. Some people call it hospitality workers.
Okay. Am I getting you in Nevada right now or where are you?
I'm in Seattle today.
Okay, Seattle today. Is your home in Nevada?
I've had a home in Nevada for a long time. Now that COVID's over, airplane tends to be my home a lot, too.
Okay, you're traveling around. But I think I first learned of Unite Here from Harry Reid, a huge champion of culinary workers in Nevada, right?
Yes.
And the culinary workers, big part of the Democratic Party in Nevada. And I always followed Harry's lead in my political action committee. Midwest Values Pack would always give to Unite Here and to the culinary workers in Nevada to get out the vote. I remember in 2010, Harry had a close one.
Yes, he did.
And we pulled that one out. And last election gave to you guys in Nevada. I think Midwest Values Pack was the first to do so, and also in Georgia for the runoff for your ground game. What I want to do is explain to the folks ground game and what role you guys play. And this year, I know that you're in Pennsylvania heavy, and you're in Nevada, and these are hugely important races so that we can keep control of the Senate.
Well, first, I actually want to really thank you. You were instrumental in 2020 in helping us raise funds so we could do the kind of ground game we needed to do in Nevada and in Georgia to win those runoffs.
And boy, that's why we have control of the Senate. And you guys knocked on what, over 1 million doors in Georgia, right?
Oh, well over. We were approaching 3 million doors in Georgia.
Wow.
We had from the Saturday after Thanksgiving through January 8th, actually, we had over 1,100 people on the ground. So people spent time away from their loved ones around Christmas. We gave people off 3 days around Christmas. And we were in five different counties in and around the Atlanta area. I had asked Stacey Abrams if it was okay if we come there, because she had sort of set the table and we weren't going to come to her dining room table without, you know, making sure that was okay. She was gracious, wonderful. And I always said we were the icing, but the cake was already baked in Georgia. And in Nevada, we won by 30,000 votes and we knocked on about 800,000 doors in Clark County, which is Las Vegas area, and in Reno, Washoe County.
I love Reno. I did Tom Davis and I did 6 weeks in Reno in 1974 or five. I can't remember, at Harrah's. Is the Basque restaurant still there?
You know, it's funny. I used to live in Northern Nevada. A lot of those Basque restaurants are gone. Reno has been completely transformed, Al. It's become a huge place for Northern Californians to move to. That Harrah's is closed down in downtown Reno. But enormous numbers of businesses have sprung up. And it is a different town, but it is certainly still a great place. When you look at, there's Lake Tahoe, there's Reno, there's all the surrounding areas that make it wonderful.
Remember the beautiful Truckee River and the hot Truckee springs River. There?
Yeah, now it's become a big whitewater river racing place.
Wow. Now, you guys also in 20 were in Pennsylvania. And you're in Arizona as well, as in Georgia and Nevada, right?
Well, we were actually in Florida, not in Pennsylvania in 20. Oh. We were in Florida, Arizona, Nevada heavily. We were in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia in particular, not the whole state, Philadelphia.
Well, that's in Pennsylvania, D.
Yeah, I didn't want you to think that we were doing the whole state. We only did that one area, Philly.
Pennsylvania, Philadelphia is a big city.
Well, you're right about that.
And turnout of Democrats in big cities is kind of important. So I'm trying to explain to D how elections work.
Good. I need it.
Okay. So you were in Pennsylvania, but in the city of Philadelphia. Okay. Right. Well, that's what I said. Geesh. And the reason I brought up Pennsylvania and Nevada and Arizona and Georgia is that we won all of them.
Yep.
We didn't win Florida, unfortunately, but we won those states and you were heavy in there. And Philadelphia, of course, very important to Pennsylvania. This year, let's talk about 22, because, oh my God, these midterms are important. We have a 50-50 Senate. Where are you working this cycle?
We're in Pennsylvania, not just in Philadelphia, and we're in Pennsylvania, we're in Nevada, and we're in Arizona.
Okay, and really important races in Pennsylvania, my God, Senate and governor. The Republicans have governor nominee there, Mastriano, who is a full-fledged right-wing. He was there at January 6th, right?
And then,
and he really is a Trumper and really believes that the election was stolen. And in Pennsylvania, the governor appoints the Secretary of State. So
very important.
This one couldn't be more important. This governor's race, I think, is maybe the most important in the country, and it's close. That is absolutely crucial. And, of course, the Senate race, which we have a really good opportunity for a pickup there. And that is Fetterman versus Oz. By the way, I'm going to be pitching throughout this to my listeners to give to Unite Here. There's no secret to my listeners that this we were at a precarious time. And I've been saying this over and over again, and I'm not alone. Everybody, a lot of people have been saying it, but man, oh man, if this is a time to step forward. I want people to get engaged. I want you to get the vote out in your area. Unite here. The ground game is so friggin' important. And it was the best investment that I made was giving to you guys, actually. Because we won in Georgia. We won those two seats, not by much. And you guys knocked on you said 3 million doors. But tell me what a ground game is and what the importance of it is.
Well, the ground game is, our concept is, no one ever talks to voters. They talk at them, whether mail, text messages, TV ads. You never hear from them. And so we have folks go out 6 days a week, all day, talking to voters. We have all electronic lists, and we at least hit every voter three times to talk to them and hear about their issues and understand their concerns and, you know, where they are at, not tell them where we're at, where they are at, and try to several things. Sometimes early, get them to register to vote. Two, if they are registered, why they should vote. So we should not assume that. And then three, to vote the right way. And we really talk about issues, and we contrast people on issues. Because if you just talk about candidates, that often falls on deaf ears. So it is the only, as I call it, real polling that goes on, because you find out where people are at the door. I call that polling of the most accurate type. So, for example, Al, I remember on election day, I was walking, you know, I still walk precinct. On election day, you know, we still had some independents to go to. And we figured out early on, the independents were not breaking for Biden. They were breaking for Trump. So we just jettisoned doing independents on a last day election day and just went to straight up D's. You would never have known that in a poll. You would never have known that any other way except if you were at the doors. And you got a real sense at the doors. And you get thrown curveballs at the doors, like why somebody says they're voting, this is for a candidate. And then you start really talking to them, explaining really what that position is or not. You're not going to get that on a TV ad. You're not going to get that in a radio ad. And also you go back because people have questions. Like they say, well, what's going on with the prescription drugs on this? And so you go back to them, you follow up. It's just basic organizing because no one else does that. And the people we have doing it are in all different languages. So, for example, if you're hitting a heavy neighborhood of Spanish speaking, or you're hitting a whole community of Tagalog speakers, that's all. Those are
Tagalog.
Yeah.
Tagalog.
Yeah.
Tell me what Tagalog is.
That's one of the languages of the Philippines.
Oh, okay. Okay.
We have large Filipino population in certain cities and who are registered to vote, but often, English is a second language. They never get anything in Tagalog. So we have Tagalog speakers out there too.
Wow. I remember in Georgia for the runoff, especially, that immediately there was all this money spent on ads and, all this money poured in for the runoff on ads. And at a certain point, the airwaves were just flooded with political ads and people couldn't watch them anymore. And just when a commercial came on, oh, okay, I'll go do whatever I have to do now. No one paid any friggin' attention and all this money went there. You guys are on the door. This was during the pandemic. So you're knocking on doors and people are home, right?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
And not only are they home, but they haven't seen anyone in a while and they want to talk to someone. So you guys were getting amazing response, right?
Yes, we were. I mean, as somebody who lives in a battleground state, Nevada, those political commercials, your brain turns them off, even if you don't turn the channel, et cetera. So I think that is a prime area where political consultants and TV stations make a ton of money. Mm-hmm. And I think they have diminishing effect. No one talks to people. We talk to people. and they talked to us.
Now, what was interesting about this, too, was that this is, again, during the pandemic, and the Biden campaign sort of made a conscious effort. We're going to model good behavior. So we're not going to do ground game. And to a great extent, they did not. And I think we got beat in certain places because Republicans did. But you guys did. And what I heard from you then was that you were taking tremendous precautions. You wouldn't put two people in a hotel room. People had their own hotel room. People wouldn't drive together, right?
Right. And
you got virtually no people got sick, right?
That's right. We had a very strict COVID protocol about masking and meetings and how many people, et cetera. And candidly, we avoided COVID at 98%. We had very, very few people because we took those precautions. So when we went to the doors, we were masked up. We kept our distance. We offered people if they wanted a mask. We had extra masks if they wanted a mask and talking to us at the door. And so I always viewed by not doing a ground game, we gave up a lot of House seats, probably gave up one or two Senate seats, which we showed that you could do a ground game during COVID. And by the way, the Trump people were on the doors. Now, they weren't right. taking COVID protocols. But if you're only talking to one side, that's never a good recipe for victory.
Yeah. So that was a lesson I hope we learned. I mean, that was that time. Obviously, now it's easier to go out and it's not a death sentence unless you have comorbidities and or very old or just unbelievably unlucky. That was something that you guys did that was, I think, thank God you did that. And it was really, really responsible and really, really smart. Let's talk about this cycle, both where you are, what the important races are, and what my people can do to help you.
Well, we're in Pennsylvania, as we talked earlier. We're in Arizona and Nevada, and it hasn't gotten any cooler in Arizona and Nevada. I mean, I think today it's 115 in Las Vegas, and I bet it's about 120 in Phoenix, and we're on the doors already.
Now, let me ask you, do you do warming? Do you do like as an issue? Like, you know, our Senate candidate is actually believes we should do something about our climate.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you live in the Southwest, you've seen climate change. Just look at Lake Mead recently. I can go on and on about climate. Clearly, it is upon us. And the idea, any deniers of that are kind of like election deniers. They don't deal with reality. But that's one of the fights we have. But what we're finding at the doors, Al, no surprise, is a lot of bread and butter issues. I mean, people are getting crushed on the cost of living. You know, when you're paying $5.50 for a gallon of gas, cost of bacon's gone up. Rents are through the roof. And it's not because they have improved those apartments. It's because, candidly, in my opinion, greedy landlords have decided to take advantage of the situation. So it is about a lot of the cost of living.
And of course, of course.
We got to deal with that.
And what are you hearing? What is the message you give back on that?
Well, I think we have to say, well, who's responsible for it? I mean, I still don't understand why we don't impose a windfall profits tax on the gas companies, because the oil companies are making profits out of the kazoo using the excuse of whatever. We talk about the gouging that's going on by companies. For rents, this is a simple fact. Private equity has now bought a huge amount of housing in our country. And that has a filter effect of raising the rents for everybody too. And we also talk about what we can do locally. So for example, in North Las Vegas, where rents went up 35%. North Las Vegas is a working class area of Las Vegas. It's far off the strip. We have put in an initiative called Neighborhood Stability about controlling how much rents can go up each year above the rate of inflation, et cetera. So it is those kind of issues. People say, oh, okay, maybe there's a way to get something solved here. In, for example, in Philadelphia, when we're walking the streets, people talk a lot about gun violence, because it's become horrible in certain parts of Philadelphia. And we have a Republican nominee who thinks you should be able to carry weapons anywhere and everywhere. That's a big issue. So you also are dealing with what people are saying at the doors locally, but you're also dealing with, you know, clearly bread and butter issues. And you're dealing with, let's say, for example, whether it's crime in a certain place or other issues.
How many people do you have on the ground in these various states?
Well, right now we have about, I think, 60 in Pennsylvania. We have, I think, 110 in Nevada, and we have between 100 and 200 in Arizona right now. But we want to get that up to 400 to 500. But the thing that restricts us is just, frankly, money, the ability to do that. And I'm afraid if we don't have those kind of folks, those kind of numbers, we'll have a very hard time winning the governor's race and the Senate race in Nevada and in Pennsylvania and in Arizona. The Senate race is so important there, too.
Yeah, it's Kelly. These governor races are important. I mean, right now we're so focused on the Republicans attacking our democracy. And so much has to do with the state legislatures and the governors. And those races, we understand, are so, so important. And so that's the governor's race in Arizona. That's going to be a close one, right?
You know, a lot of times the Democrats focus on these federal elections. Well, I'll put it this way. The person running for Secretary of State in Nevada is a complete election denier. And same thing in Arizona. So you have situations where the very person to oversee elections actually does not believe in democracy. I always find it interesting when they talk about the cancel culture. How can anything be more cancellationist than saying your vote didn't count in 2020? And every time a Republican wins, there's never a call that the elections were rigged or whatever. Anytime a Democrat wins, they say the election was stolen or that somehow or another it was manipulated.
So your focuses now are Arizona, Nevada, and Pennsylvania.
Yes.
Okay. Are you usually able to scale up? How many people do you want to get on the ground?
400 to 500. And we need that. We'd like to have that by beginning of September, because remember, the election supposedly is the beginning week of November, but early voting starts sometimes in late September.
Right.
So people start voting in September. So we consider election day outside of Pennsylvania, which is much more traditional election day. But in Arizona and Nevada, it's early voting. That's where you win or lose elections. Always. That's where you win or lose elections. And also with the mail ballot, people can mail at any point. You got to be talking to people all the time.
Where do people go to give? Just give us a.
They can go to your PAC because you've been great.
Thank you. Midwest Values PAC is my PAC. We've given, we give as much as we can to you guys. And I think we've given about, 100,000 this cycle,
right,
or something so far.
Yep. But they can go to unitehere.org/win2022.
Okay, say that again.
unitehere.org/win2022.
I'm very proud to support you because you guys do the work that protects our democracy. Thank God for you guys. Thank God we have 50 Democrats in the Senate, and we wouldn't have had them without Warnock and Ossoff, and we wouldn't have had them without you. So, and I wish, I want to have 52. I want to have 53.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, because we haven't been able to get as much done, obviously, as we would have liked. If you know, and we need a couple more, and we have the opportunity to do it. We have an opportunity for a pickup in Pennsylvania. We have in Nevada and Arizona. We have to hold on to those seats, and it's a real challenge, I think, especially in Nevada. But we just have to do that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I remember the 2010 race, which you referred earlier about Harry Reid. We had a huge ground game, and we need another huge ground game. And I think short of that, we're going to have a very, very difficult time of holding on to that seat. I don't say that to sell anything. I don't say that because Catherine Cortez Masto is not a really good senator. But often as Democrats, we read the press that we're going to lose or we're not going to win. And so we don't do anything. That's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Apathy and cynicism are the tools of the folks who don't want us to win. So I think we have to decide whether we want to, in my opinion, save democracy in this country. And I'm not going to tell you it's the most important election because you hear that all the time. I just want you to imagine if the Republicans are in control of the Senate, what that means for the next 2 years as far as getting anything done in this country.
Well, you know why it isn't the most important election in history? Because that was 1860. But this is second most. So no, this is a scary one. And we can win in those states. And also, I think that people are paying attention to what the Supreme Court has done. I mean, are you hearing that on the doors? Are you hearing about the
court? We hear a little bit of that. But most of the people we're talking to, they're figuring out how they're going to pay rent that's gone up 25%. Or, bluntly, as school year starts coming around the corner, how they're going to get some new clothes for their kids because they've had to pay a lot more for gas or food. I mean, it's real survival time for a lot of
And what's your families. Message at the door in terms of because they blame Biden for that?
Oh, yeah. No, there's no question. So there's no question about that. What they really do is no one's doing anything about this. And they don't want to hear about the geopolitical ramifications of Ukraine or something like that. I think you have to talk about how this inflation occurred and what we have to do to fight it. Now, no one thinks the Republicans are going to save them. What we have more than anything else is that they're not going to vote Republican. They're just not going to vote. And we've got to change that.
It's good for us to hear what you're hearing at the door.
Yep. Well, that's what we're hearing at the door. Why bother? Mm-hmm. You came 2 years ago. We elected Biden and things have only gotten worse. So what's their plan to stop the cost of living? I mean, Al, you'll appreciate this. I have one of my daughters is 27. And I was with her the other week and she goes, Dad, what's going on? When are gas prices going to go down? I mean, remember that a lot of generations, they've never experienced inflation. Now, us who are a little longer in the tooth, remember inflation back in the day. And it is a corrosive thing. And so the other effect that's going on is how we fight back on that, not just with politics, at least with the labor movement. We're talking about striking. We're talking about fighting back because corporations are doing quite well. The average worker isn't. And so we've got to change that narrative. We've got to change and we've got to force them to do the right thing. But on inflation, we've got to take it head on. If you don't take on the cost of living head on at the doors, you're not going to have people listen to you often.
What is your message to them?
Our message is the corporations are taking advantage of this. Do you really think the corporations are going to do the right thing under the Republicans? Or should we fight back and elect these Democrats and force them to take on these corporations and how they're gouging us?
And is that effective?
We'll see. We also talk about local issues and bread and butter issues, like, for example, on rent. You know, the price of gas is going down now. Okay, great. The price of food is not going down. And we just have to talk about fighting back, because if you say that if you elect some person, they're going to solve it, that's just not true. And plus, a lot of those people are in office now. So we say we got to force them to fight the corporations and how they are ripping us off.
Well, I just can't thank you enough for what you guys do and your commitment. And how long have you been doing this?
I've been doing it 41 years.
Okay. And how old are you?
I'm 65.
Okay. So by my calculation, you're starting when you were 24.
Started working for the union. I actually was a shop steward in a restaurant when I was 22.
Okay. All right. But I thought you'd be impressed by my math. Well, Dee, thank you again. I'll look forward to giving you guys more from MVP, and I hope my listeners do as well. And hopefully, maybe joining you in one of these on the door someday.
Yeah, it would be great. Hey, listen, we got a big operation in Reno. You can come back to Reno and have your second act.
Okay, maybe when it cools off a little.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week.